Good afternoon. Welcome to Lion One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. On a dark day in 1977, Iris Bolton and her husband Jack lost their son Mitch to suicide at the age of 20. Since that tragic day, Iris has devoted her life to finding meaning from that loss and her career to helping people recover from the devastation that suicide leaves behind. I'd like to start off today's show with an excerpt from a poem written by Iris, simply titled, "The Suicide of My Son." My son lies cruel and cold today. He'll never touch another. My son lay kind and warm before. I know I am his mother. His troubled heart, his bleeding soul, his tormented body lies. Yet lived he 20 years today, and now he's closed his eyes. His friends parade in solemn quest, searching the world to find some meaning or some purpose in his tormented mind. My anger and my burning rage conflict with loving him. I pray for inner strength and peace, for healing to begin. I seek to still my soul's unrest, to calm the hell within, not knowing if or how or when acceptance will begin. Joining me to discuss finding meaning after suicide is Atlanta-based therapist Iris Bolton. Since her son's death, Iris has immersed herself in the study of suicide, hoping to help others touched by suicide find reasons to live. Iris is the director emeritus of the Link Counseling Center in Atlanta, Georgia. She graduated from Columbia University and holds a master's degree from Emory University in Atlanta with a major in suicidology. Iris has spent the last 40 years helping people heal from one of the most traumatic events that can happen in one's lifetime. Welcome to the show, Iris. I really appreciate you taking the time to join me today.
Thank you, Prentice. It's my honor to be here.
Okay. I need to remind listeners, this is a call-in show, so you can reach us locally by calling 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Or if you're outside of Anchorage, you can reach us toll-free from anywhere you might be at 1-888-353-5752. The last way is to email your questions or comments to line1@alaskapublic.org. If it's first time emailing, you got to spell out line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, @alaskapublic.org. I want to remind listeners that if you have a question for Iris or a comment or a story from your own life you'd like to share on air today, you can reach us. Well, we've already done that, so we'll move on. So Iris, a little bit of background. You and I go way back. You've been friends with my parents for a long time, and I've known you since I was, I guess, a wee kid, huh?
That's absolutely right. You were a little fella, and adorable, I might add.
Oh, well, thanks. Yeah. All right. Can you tell us a little bit about the work you're doing in the field of suicidology, and what does that exactly mean?
Well, the field has three areas, actually. One is prevention. What can we do to prevent suicide is what people struggle with. And then the second one is intervention. How do we intervene if we see the warning signs in someone? You think they're depressed, you see the signs, and you need to intervene so they don't do something to harm themselves. And then the third area is postvention, or most of us call it aftercare, after the event has happened and you are dealing with the grief and the loss and the shock of all of this, then that's the third area. So prevention, intervention, and postvention or aftercare. And I've been working in this field since 1977. I was the director of the Link Counseling Center in Atlanta, Georgia, which I helped found in 1971. Because at that time in Atlanta, Georgia, kids were running away and families were having a terrible time not knowing what to do, to chase them down, leave them alone, hope they'll come home, whatever. And I got involved in that. And then in 1977, on February 19th, our second-born son, Mitch, who was 20 years old, shot and killed himself in his bedroom. And, of course, that just turned our world upside down, and I thought I would never live through it. It was a time when nobody talked about suicide. It was just such a a bad word and brought up such terrible thoughts that nobody talked about it. It was really in the closet. And so when that happened, of course, I was in shock. My family and I struggled with how do you survive it, because there was nobody who could stand in front of us and say, well, here's some things to do and here's some things not to do. And so we struggled with it, but eventually I did make the decision to survive, and we all did in our family. I have three other sons. And a lot of good has come from our being able to assimilate it into our lives somehow over a long period of time, lots of hard work, lots of pain, and lots of counseling for me. I was a therapist and am a therapist, so it was just really, I think, a little harder than it might have been, although it's hard no matter what, because I was a counselor myself and was working with other people. So I felt I was a failure, not only as a therapist, but as a mother, you know, in many, many ways. So over years, and that was a long time ago, in 1977, when this happened, and eventually a lot of good came out of it because we chose to survive and help others.
Well, that was a great summary of just about everything we're going to cover in more detail.
Good.
That was perfect. So, yeah, today's is on postvention or after suicide, and I've wanted to do this topic for quite some time because we have done couple of shows on suicide prevention and intervention, and obviously that's very important work. But the reality is that suicide happens. No matter how much effort we put into trying to prevent it or intervene, suicide happens. And what happens next is really, really important. So can you start us off by just telling us a little bit about Mitch as a person and what he struggled with that might have led him to take his life?
Well, you really never know, but yes, we were so devastated because he was the life of the party. He was the son. We had four sons. John was 22 at the time. Mitch was 20. Billy, we called him, was 16, and Bobby was 14. So four boys having a wonderful time in life. We were just, we had a cabin on the lake at Lake Burton as a second home in Georgia. And we thought life was wonderful. We knew that Mitch was the life of the party. He had many, many, many friends, and he had too many girlfriends. So we realized that at one point he had asked three of those girls to marry him. And I think he got himself in a bind in a box that he didn't know how to get out of.
Sounds like.
Also, yeah, he was a ladies' man for sure. And we can laugh about that now. But I think what happened was he got himself in a box and didn't know how to get out of it. Also, at the same time, he was getting depressed. And he masked his depression. So it didn't. It looked like when one of the girlfriends, the one we knew about, the only one we really knew was a girlfriend, the others we thought were acquaintances. But when that happened, when he was really going through a loss of her because she broke up with him, and this was 3 weeks before he died. And I think he was so shocked that someone would not like him or love him or would turn him down because he was so popular. He was good looking, had long curly hair, sang, played the guitar, played the piano, funny, all of that. And I think inside he was feeling like an imposter, that if you knew the real me and knew how depressed I was, you wouldn't like me, you wouldn't love me. And so he began to beat himself up, I think, in his mind. And when the girl decided she was going to break up with him, the one we knew about, I think he was just devastated. No one had ever said no to him, really, in terms of a love life. And so I think it was a shock, and I think he was stricken. We must have missed some signs of his depression because he masked them by normal grieving over the girlfriend who broke up with him 3 weeks prior to his death. So I think that built and built, and his imposter syndrome of thinking, if you really knew me, you wouldn't like me, I'm not lovable, all that, I'm not the personality kid you think I am. Those kinds of deprecating thoughts spiraled him down and down and down. And I think that was not the cause of his suicide, but I think it was the last straw. Usually there's a loss that involves the last moments or the last event in their lives. It's a loss of face, a loss of friendship, a loss moving somewhere, loss of a girlfriend, boyfriend, something like that. So I think he was really ripe for deciding to give up on life because he couldn't see how to get out of these relationships. He didn't like himself or love himself anymore. We had sat up one night talking long into the night about his breakup, and he was very sad and teary, and I thought that was about the breakup. In hindsight, I think he must have really been more depressed than I understood. He was a good actor. He didn't want me to know because he knew I'd probably put him in the hospital. And so I think he just wanted to get out of it, to end the pain. And that is, we struggle with why over and over and over. Why would anybody do this? And it's, I don't think it's one thing, but I think one of the aspects is pain. Pain that they don't think will ever, ever leave them. And they believe that if that pain is going to be with them the rest of their lives, they cannot tolerate it. Therefore, they're going to die to get out of the pain.
Yeah, sustained pain at that level is just too much.
Mm-hmm.
All right, I read you've written two books, Voices of Healing and Hope, and that was your second book. And your first book, My Son, My Son, I just read this past week. And it's a powerful book and one that I recommend to anybody who's going through it. You talk quite candidly about Mitch's suicide and that day and the funeral. Can you just share briefly what that was like, what you guys went through as a family and the impact it had on you in the days, the aftermath?
Well, I think you're in such shock. Every family responds differently to that event, depending on the relationships and the dynamics in the family and all of that. But we were a very close family, and so when this happened, it was such a shock. Our home filled with friends. They just flooded our home, and most of them just said, "I'm sorry," because there's not much else you can say. Some of them took our boys and wanted to give them entertainment. Actually, they wanted to be with us, so we kept us pretty much together, but they did go off with friends. But the funeral is kind of a blur at this point. You know, it's a good thing I wrote about it because in time, you really forget what all that pain is because it's so awful you just can't contain it. Or I guess you'd go crazy yourself. You just couldn't handle it. But what I do remember is that people filled the church. We were honest about it. And back in 1977, nobody talked about suicide. So we felt we had to, that we couldn't keep it a secret, that we needed to share it, and it needed to come out of the closet. And so we told everybody the truth. And we felt that we could live with the truth. We couldn't live with a lie. And so that's what we did. And the funeral, there were so many people, they couldn't all get in the church. And it was of great comfort to us to have people there. It's not even what they said. Some people put their foot in their mouth and said strange things like, "Oh, well, he's better off now." Well, who knows that? That's not a very comfortable thing to hear. "Oh, well, you have other children." Well, certainly they can't replace him. So there were some people who were just out of their ineptness and not knowing what to say and their inexperience and their awkwardness, they may have said some things that were unkind, but they didn't mean it. They just didn't know what else to say. Most people were loving, supportive, kind, would do anything for us. Our family gathered round, and I didn't pour myself a glass of water for 3 weeks, which is kind of interesting, being a caregiver myself.
Right.
You know, it was like I just let people take care of me, which is really unusual. And I learned a great lesson to let people give care to you because you need it. And they get something out of giving it, just like I've always done. When I gave something to some people or listened to them or supported them, it helped me as well as it helped them. So it was a nightmare. I don't know how to describe it other than that, but it was a time when we decided we would do this as a family and we would survive it. I had started therapy 3 months, excuse me, prior to Mitch's death, just in learning how to deal with life. And I'm a therapist, so I think every therapist should have their own therapy. And my therapist came to the house that day, and he said, "Your son, this is strange to hear, but your son may have given you a gift." Well, I knew this man and trusted him, so I knew he knew something more than I did, but my husband was ready to punch him out, as you can imagine. But today, even, my husband will say, there is a gift in this if you're willing to look at it. And the gift is our being on the conversation right now, maybe perhaps helping and touching one other person who's going through this and knows they're not alone and knows they will survive. And there are some things that you can do to help reach out for yourself and your family to get through it.
Yeah, I think the quote from Jack to your therapist was, "I hear the words you're saying, but they don't make any sense."
Right, exactly. And they wouldn't to most people. I just knew him as a therapist and knew him as a wise person and thought, well, he knows something I don't know. I don't know what he's saying. I don't get it, but he must know something more than I do about this.
Right. Can you go through, in the Voices of Healing and Hope, you talk about the 8 primal cycles of grief, and you have a DVD in that book that, where people go through and they're interviewed and they speak about each of these primal cycles. Can you discuss those for people who might not be familiar? They're a little bit different than the normal stages of grief that you usually hear about. Can you talk about those and how you've outlined them in your book?
Absolutely. I guess the first one is why, because we want to we all struggle with why. I think that's mostly the first question people ask. Why would anybody do this? Most of us are trying to live. You know, we don't want to get sick. We don't want to get cancer. We want to live. So why does somebody not want to live? And the why question is something that I struggled with, we all struggled with, my sons struggled with it, and there aren't any answers, except that each person probably has a different combination of events that happen in their lives, or attitudes, or feelings, or experiences that cause them to feel about themselves a certain way, which is negative. They're in so much pain that they don't see how they can go on living with the pain, and they believe that the pain will never leave them. And so at some point when there's a loss, there's a trigger of some kind, that their best friend moves away, the girlfriend breaks up with them, whatever that might be, that seems to trigger it, not cause it necessarily. Wonderful example that was used with me was like the cup of water. And if grief is like a cup of water, and the cup is all the way full to the top, rounded at the top because it's so full. Doesn't spill. You add one more drop into that cup and it spills. And we're a culture that wants to blame, so we're going to blame the one drop of water. When the reality is it wasn't spilling before that drop went in, so it had to be a combination of everything in the bottle of water or the cup of water and the drop. So if that represents life, then all the experiences in life, the failures, the discontent, the losses, the whatever, the traumas they've had in their life, plus one other last drop, that seems to cause the action to end one's life. So that's the why that we struggle with. And it's not one reason. People say it's my fault. No, I don't think it's any one person's fault. It is that combination of things that build and build and build until there seems to be a major loss of some sort, and that's the final last straw to end the pain.
You're talking about the straw that broke the camel's back.
Exactly.
I just need to take a second to remind folks who might be tuning in late, my guest today is Atlanta-based therapist and suicidologist Iris Bolton, whose son Mitch died by suicide in 1977. Our topic today is how to heal and find meaning in life after losing a loved one to suicide. If you have a question for Iris or an experience you'd like to share with us, please don't hesitate to call in or email. As always, you can reach us in 3 ways. Our local phone number is 550-8433, or you can reach us toll-free from anywhere you might be listening at 1-888-353-5752. And the last way is to email your question to lion1@alaskapublic.org. I just want to read real quickly from something from my son, about the question why. You said, "It is important, however, to ask why. It is important to worry about why, because one finally exhausts possibility after possibility, and ultimately one tires of the fruitless search. Then it's time to let go and to start healing."
Yes, that's so true. That's a complete statement in itself, isn't it?
Yeah.
It really is true.
Okay, the second...
The second one is guilt, and that just seems to overpower most of us who have this loss in our lives, because you can't help but think it's your fault. Now, not everybody feels guilty. Some people know they have done everything they know to do to help this person, and it didn't help. Nothing helps. That person is determined. So I think there are times when, even though you know that they might be suicidal, you know they might be depressed, you can't stop them. But there are most of the times, or many times, when I think you can reach that person. A psychiatrist I know said the only thing that can save a human life is another human life.
Hmm.
In other words, just a person who will listen and give them hope and be there for them. So listening is one of the greatest gifts you can give someone. But the guilt is natural and it's normal. That self-blame, what did I do? It's my fault. If only, you know, if I hadn't, if only, what if, all of those things. So guilt is huge. And my therapist said, wallow in the guilt until you get tired of it. I had started therapy, as I said, 3 months prior to Mitch's death, just because I'm a therapist and knew that every therapist must have his own therapy to work with other people to get their own issues dealt with. And so I had started therapy. So, of course, he came to our home immediately when someone called him and told him what had happened. And he just eventually, during my therapy, he said, wallow in the guilt. Write a list of every reason it's your fault. What is your guilt? Why are you so responsible for this event? And then he would have me list it all over again. And then he would have me wallow in it until eventually I got tired of that list and thought, that's absurd. I did the best I knew to do. I was the best mother I knew to be. What Mitch did was his choice, not mine. But it took a long time to get to that place, as you can imagine.
I bet. All right, we have our first caller, so we're going to go ahead and go to the phone lines. Sarah, you're on line one with Iris. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Sarah, and Prentice and I, we worked together a long time ago in Wasilla.
Oh, yes.
I'm a counselor in the community. I'm also a pastor, and my concern has been the last few times I've been to the funerals of people who have committed suicide, the focus by some of the ministers has been on the saving of souls and not on dealing with, you know, the issues that would bring somebody to suicide, or to support the family, or to bring about a change in understanding how deep depression is and things like this. And I just wanted to know what your comments are and if there's any kind of material out there that can be brought to especially the faith community. Thank you.
That's a great question. I'm sure Iris has an answer for that one. She's been to a lot of these funerals.
I don't think there are answers to this issue. I really don't. I think we have some ideas. We have some, you know, options that you can use and different things, but I don't think there are answers, just to preface that.
All right.
I have experienced that, but it's really interesting that you ask this, because I don't think anybody has written on why this happens, why pastors do this, except they may not know what else to do. They are not trained in suicide postvention or aftercare. And so they come up with what they're used to, which is saving souls. And so I don't think there's anybody who has written about this. So maybe, Sarah, you need to write a book about it.
Well, thank you. I actually am thinking of doing some writing, yes. Thank you.
Well, really, that's, I think that's a void. We had one man who was a minister who used way back in 1978, in the 80s, we were on a council together, and he has since died himself of an accident, I think it was. But he was a minister trying to help people not do that, other ministers not do that. And there were some trainings of ministers, and occasionally you get some training. But the only place I would know for you to go would be the American Association of Suicidology, which you I think is capital A, capital A, capital A, AAS.
Okay.
And you could go on the Internet. It's probably AAS.org. And the other one is American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, and that's AF, as in Frank, AFSP. Both of those are the top organizations that do AFSP does a lot of research, and you might suggest to them that somebody do some research on this. And if there is anything out there that's already written, they would know, as would AAS. And I just don't have anything about that. It's a really great question. So please write your book and your ideas, because you probably have better ones than anybody, because you've lived it.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate
You're
the
so
program
welcome.
And I appreciate all your work.
Thanks for
thank
the call,
you.
Sarah. My thought, I mean, that kind of leads me into another point here. And my thought is that the discomfort that people have with suicide and the stigma and the not knowing what to say and the shame and the how do you talk to somebody about that might contribute to that. They just sort of gloss it over. You mentioned the importance of naming it, of calling it, of talking about suicide as the way that your loved one died. Can you just briefly touch on stigma and shame? I know that's one of the eight principles of grief that you talk about.
Yes, it is. Well, shame is there for most people, not everyone, but especially in rural areas where there's less sophistication about loss and grief and all of those things, and they're more isolated. That's probably why. And most people feel that shame. Certainly in 1977, there was tremendous shame in our family because we thought that we were being talked about, that we didn't know another soul that this had happened to. Fortunately now, we've been talking about it for 40 years, and the legislature, Congress, has devoted money now to research in prevention, intervention, and finally some aftercare. And so shame is now being talked about. All these issues are being talked about. And the more we talk about something, the better people understand it and don't have to feel that shame. There should not be shame. It's like cancer. Do you remember when cancer was, everybody was hidden, nobody talked about it, and if you had it, you were ashamed? There was the same kind of stigma about cancer, believe it or not, and that's gone now. Well, how did that happen? Probably through education. And we're trying to do the same thing with suicide, but it's harder because there's so many emotions. Of course, there were in cancer, too,
right,
and still are in some cases. But it's really hard to go through it. It's hard to name it, but it is possible to do once you name it and once you really talk to other people and you deal with it and ask, get some help about it. Go through the guilt to the shame to the other side of all of that. And that's part of what I write about in Voices of Healing and Hope, and a little bit, I guess, in My Son, my first book, which we've just revised by now. I just didn't know whether you knew that, but we revised it just recently and didn't change the content except to change punctuation, perhaps. My father was the editor on it, and he has since died many years ago. He was an editor and a publisher, and so he helped me edit it, and there were some things that we wanted to get the bibliography up to date and the resources up to date, so that's what we've done with that book. And that's the book to read if you're first into this. If you have a suicide in your family, that's the book to get to just learn how do you go through this, what do you do, how do you handle it, where do you get help. And then later on, the Voices of Healing and Hope, Conversations on Grief After Suicide, is much more down the road. It's more a resource book for people. But it has video, a DVD in the back of people sharing their stories. I asked them, what happened? What was the hardest part? What helped you the most? And where are you today? And I think they're so inspiring, this DVD that's in the back, and because it tells about shame and guilt, and it speaks to why, and tells what they thought and what they went through and where are they today. And every one of them has survived and is helping other people today. So that just thrills me, and I wanted to document that.
Yes, and you did a remarkable job. I just got done watching about an hour plus of that this morning, so I'm going to go back. But one of the things I really like about my son is that you go through every one of these things. And right here I have a passage underlined where you speak about your shame. You said, I had flunked the supreme test of motherhood, the delivery of a self-confident, valuable citizen to society. Instead, I had delivered a corpse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those are pretty strong words, huh?
Yes, and I mean, clearly you were still feeling a lot of that shame and guilt, and your work as a therapist complicated it because, you know,
absolutely.
As you said, you're supposed to be able to recognize this stuff, and how can you help other families if you can't recognize it in your own?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Oh, I was feeling like a failure. A failure as a mother, a failure as a therapist, just a big failure. And I didn't think I could live, but I had to make that choice. Yes, I could. I had to live for my family, for myself, for my husband. And we all made a commitment that we would never, ever do this. We promised each other we would never give up on life and end our lives like this. And that was a good thing that could come from his death.
Another gift.
Yes, another gift. They keep popping up in spite of what we think.
Okay, we are at the halfway point in our show, so we're going to go ahead and take a short break. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on KSK Anchorage. My guest today is Atlanta-based therapist and suicidologist Iris Bolton, whose son Mitch died by suicide in 1977. Our topic today is how to heal and find meaning in life after losing a loved one to suicide. If you have a question for Iris or a story you want to share, please don't hesitate to reach out. Our local phone number is 550-8433, or you can reach us toll-free from anywhere at 1-888-353-5752. And the last way is to email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, we'll return to our conversation with Iris Bolton. I'm Prentice Pemberton.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line One on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. If you're just joining us, my guest today is Atlanta-based therapist and suicidologist Iris Bolton, who got into the field of helping others who've dealt with suicide after her son Mitch died by suicide in 1977. Her topic today is how to heal and find meaning in life after losing a loved one to suicide. If you have a question for Iris and her experience you want to share about today's topic, you can reach us in three ways. Our local phone number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. And the last way to participate is to email your question to line1@alaskapublic.org. Please remember the show repeats tonight at 8, so if you're listening to this on Monday evening, you'll be hearing a tape recording, and we will not be able to accept phone calls. Okay, Iris, I quickly am realizing that we have a lot to talk about and about 20 minutes left, and we're not going to get through it all. But I do want to, I was struck in the tapes and the DVD that you did in your second book at how people spoke about suicide. The grief from suicide is different from the grief experienced by deaths from accidents or drug overdoses or illness. How is it different? Why do you think that is?
Well, it feels very different, and there is some research to show that it is different, although some people are not quite sure that that's true. But for the person who loses somebody by suicide, it feels very, very different because there is that shame. There is not always suddenness. Sometimes it is sudden, but sometimes someone has been threatening or attempting for years, actually. And then when it does happen, that is a surprise. But it feels like such a rejection of life when the rest of the world is trying so hard to live and doctors are trying to save your lives in so many ways, that when somebody gives up on life, it's not the right order of things. It just it doesn't compute. It doesn't make sense to someone who has never been depressed or who can't believe that somebody would go to those extremes. So I think that is one thing. The other is the stigma to it makes it different. Now, there aren't many other deaths that have such a stigma to them anymore. Cancer doesn't anymore. But it does have a huge stigma to it. And people feel that everyone is looking at them, blaming them. What did you do wrong? What did you do to this person to make them be suicidal and then act on those thoughts and feelings? So it feels different to people in those ways, and it feels like a personal rejection, like that person prefers death to life with us, with me. So it can feel devastating to a person because they don't understand it at all. And particularly if you've never been depressed yourself and someone in your family does it, or a close friend or a colleague, you just don't understand at all, and it's impossible to get even close to the answer why.
Yeah, the one of the things that really struck me in the DVD was a Marine's father who said that if your son dies in battle, soldiers show up and people come and they want to talk to you and tell you about the, you know, what a hero he was. But when someone dies by suicide, there's a lot of silence.
Exactly. Wasn't that a beautiful interview? That father is very articulate, and he's willing to share his story and does so on the DVD in the book Voices. I was very, very touched by him and his story.
Yeah, that was a powerful moment, and it spoke to me about the difficulty with that loved ones have. It's sort of like you're maybe the closest thing I could think of is your son, you know, or daughter dies from a heroin addiction or, you know, something like that, that, again, with mental health and addiction and suicide, that stigma and that shame that goes along, you don't want to tell anybody.
Right. And we're having a terrible time with our veterans right now and even some of the military. I think one of the statistics is two military people a day are dying by suicide. And that may be a low figure, I'm not sure, but it's a terrible number. One is a terrible number. If our military are feeling so awful and so depressed with nowhere to turn, and they have to hide their feelings because it's not cool to be a soldier or a service person and have a mental illness or be depressed.
It's a very macho culture and, strong. It's not okay to ask for help.
That's right. That's right. And that's what we have to teach people. It is okay. It's like if something's wrong with my car, I will go to a mechanic. And if I don't trust that one, I'll go to a second one. If I don't like that one, I'll go to someone until I find someone I trust with my car, and I will ask for help. But why is it that we do less when it's our mind and our soul that's hurting and something's wrong or off? Why do we not go to one therapist or a second or a third till we find that person we can trust? And our mental health system is not good because it's too expensive. Some people can't access it. They can't afford it. So we have a lot of work to do in this field, as you know. You've been working in it a long time yourself.
Right. Okay, I got an email in response to our caller earlier, a response to Sarah. It says, I'm writing in response to the caller who was a psychotherapist and pastor. My guess is that because the Catholic Church, and this could be one of them, considers suicide a mortal sin and does not allow a person to be buried on consecrated ground if they committed suicide, that this has led to hundreds of years of concealing suicide. The Reformation happened in less than 500 years ago, so all of Christendom has had to deal with the doctrine of mortal sin for a long, long time. Hopefully, faith-based people of all religions and spiritual teachings will, with moderninity, easy word, will realize that there are dogmas in religion that actually are harmful rather than helpful to human beings.
Oh, that's beautifully said, really beautifully said. Yeah, and I think he's absolutely right on. But there are many Catholic churches now that are allowing people to be buried in hallowed ground. That's changing a little bit.
It seems to be shifting.
Shifting is a good word. Mm-hmm. Thank goodness.
Okay, so that leads us to the next principle that you write about in your book, and anger. Can you talk about that response to suicide? Because it seems really contradictory or a hard emotion to hold. For somebody that is now deceased.
Yes, anger is a typical thing that many people have about this loss, but they hold it in because they're not supposed to be angry at somebody who's just died. So there's that prohibition of it. But on the other hand, anger is just another normal, natural emotion. And one needs to deal with it and understand that there is legitimate anger that this person made this terrible choice, made a mistake perhaps with their life. And what do we do now without them? There's legitimate anger. So they have to go through that anger. And it was interesting because a friend of mine said, Iris, you may be angry at your son, and if you want to be alone, that's fine, but if you want someone with you, I would love to do that for you. I'll be there for you, which just meant everything to me. It gave me permission to be angry, and I chose eventually to go to his grave. It was probably a year and a half later, and I was able to cry and speak to my son and say how angry I was and what a loss it was for the world. He was a very talented, gifted singer and poet, and it was just a loss, and so that made me angry, and I wanted him here, and I couldn't have him here. I could do nothing about it other than look at my behavior and see what I could learn from his death and find a way to find healing and peace in my own soul and help my family with that, which is what I've done. I think these two books have helped me more than anybody, probably.
Yeah, well, you talk about the importance of feeling what you're feeling until you're not feeling it anymore, of like going through
it. Wear it out.
Yeah, really, just like beating it to death. Really,
right,
just
exactly.
Just working that whatever you're feeling is okay, but don't reject it.
Exactly. And don't judge it. It's normal. All those feelings are normal that we've mentioned, every single one of them. They're just feelings to work through and help you understand. Help you grow. I don't grow very much when everything's going well, but if I look at it and name it and pay attention to it and get some help with it, usually I go to somebody who's wiser than I am and a counselor, a therapist, and help me deal with it. So they can help you get through it, and because otherwise it's going to hurt you. It's going to hurt anybody else. It's going to hurt you, and the anger can eat you up.
Yeah, I have said quite often on this show that the wisest people in history seek counsel, and that does not necessarily mean a therapist. You mentioned a lot of friends, and you had a lot of therapist friends, so I guess that might help.
But,
but friends and pastors and other family members can be a great source if they will sit and hear you.
Oh, absolutely. And one of the ways you make meaning, if it happens to you, is to maybe just help one other person. If somebody in the neighborhood has this happen to them, you can go to them if you have been through it and say to them, this happened to us, and share your story and share that you're doing better now and you're okay and they will survive. By the way, I wanted to say that your dad, a therapist, was one of the people that helped me the most. He was just an angel and listened and listened and listened and let me cry and didn't make me feel that was a bad thing to do. He just said, let it out.
Yeah, so many of the names in the book took me back to my childhood. You mentioned Dan Merman and Bruce Pemberton,
right.
Who's my father, who's been on the show a couple of times talking about anger. Right now, we're going to go back to the phones. We have Lisa, you're on line one. Go ahead.
Hi, I just wanted to make a comment about the father that you had mentioned earlier. I grew up in rural Alaska, so unfortunately I've worn a lot of different hats for a lot of different, had a lot of different perspectives on suicide, both family members, friends, just in coworkers, in a lot of different ways. And what I've noticed is that, even for my own stuff, like the father said, if someone dies by suicide, it's hard to come around.
Yes.
And then if they do, it's nobody wants to acknowledge what actually happened, so there's this fear there. But that happens also even when you're working through mental health stuff to prevent a suicide. Like if you've identified that this is an issue and you're doing work as a family to prevent it from happening,
yes.
The same thing happens. Your loved ones, your family, the people you're closest to, they don't come around. They don't know how to help. They don't know what to say. And so it causes a lot of isolation. And then it just feeds the shame, because the reality is they're not necessarily judging you that you failed as a parent, but they just don't know what to do and they don't know what to say. And then it feeds into itself. And the longer they stay away, the harder it is to come around.
Yeah.
And I just thought, if there's a lot of components to that, both with our whole society and what we have, our perspectives on suicide, but also individually. And I've just wondered if you address these things in your book and talk about empathy and compassion and those topics.
Well, I trust that I do. I believe I have. But you're absolutely right. And I think it becomes our job as survivors, lost survivors we call ourselves, is to educate our friends and family. It isn't helpful when you don't come around anymore. I really need you to talk to me about this. If it's too hard, then I totally understand it. But please don't treat me like I'm invisible. Please let's deal with this tragedy that's happened. We can do this together. We end up having to educate. That's why I've done workshops for years and years now, trying to help people learn how to talk about it so that lost survivors are not isolated. And it's really kind of an anomaly that we as survivors have to teach other people, the society, how to talk to us when this happens. But that's the way it is. And so I think that becomes one of our tasks, is to help people understand how to help us. They want to help. I don't think it's that they don't want to. They don't know how. So we have to teach them how. And I think that I'm not sure which book, which would be better to help you with this part, or I can't remember well enough the first one I wrote 40 years ago. So I'm not sure whether that would be more helpful or the Voices of Healing and Hope. Prentice, you might know, because you read them both recently.
Yeah, I've been through them both. And Lisa, that's a great question. And the things that popped into my mind right off the bat were that people, the first part about people not wanting, if you're dealing with intervention work, people don't want to think that it could happen to them or to their family or somebody close to them. So there's a denial piece, not in my family. And then the other part is after suicide, that stigma and that shame is people's discomfort with vulnerability, with not knowing what to say to somebody who's just lost someone to suicide. And I think for anybody listening who runs into that, it's okay to not know. It's okay to just show up. Iris, you said that in your book really well, my son, that just having people come and hug you and hold you and say, I love you and I care about you, that was one of the most powerful things for you in what I read. Not
and
necessarily
other people,
words.
You're absolutely right. Yeah, you're so right. Yeah, so glad you brought that up.
Okay, Lisa, thank you for the call.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to keep going with phone calls. We're running out of time here, but we have time for maybe one or two more. Susan, you're on line one with Iris Bolton. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. This is a question about how to help people from in a distant situation. My daughter's boyfriend's father committed suicide in early June, and it was just a real shock. I'm not close to the family, but I don't want to come across as being a know-it-all. And is there a resource? I will assume that they're taking steps to help themselves, but as an acquaintance, what support? And I've already listened to some calling and writing notes or something, but what other direction would you take?
Well, that's a good question, too, because so many people are trying to help long distance or don't know what to do. And it sounds like the notes are always helpful. A phone call is always helpful. I don't want to intrude, but I just wondered if you knew about this resource. Are you familiar with support groups? They're all over the country. Are you familiar with these organizations? In the back of both books, I have updated resources lists of all the organizations in the country that you can get material from about how to help, how to prevent it, what the warning signs are, how to intervene, and what to do long distance even. So trusting your instincts, I think, is probably a really good thing. But a note is such a wonderful thing. And to contact the people who are related to them to say, do they know about this resource? Is there any way I can get that to them? I'm so concerned about them. But have you read this book? Have you read that resource? Do you know about support groups? Those kinds of things mean more to anybody. Just the fact that somebody has not forgotten. And even on a holiday, sending a note, a card that just says, thinking of you at this time, or something like that. It sounds trite, but it's really helpful. It's amazing how helpful that
thank
is.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you so much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Iris, I think you make a good point that getting those resources to people who are close to them, because a lot of times the people who are close, who are in it, are up to their eyeballs and making meals and doing laundry and all the things that day-to-day that somebody who's just lost somebody can't really get around to. So, you know, being a resource for the person's resource is a really good thing to just send those. And I would highly recommend either of these books. I mean, I think My Son, I just read it and I had goosebumps all week reading it, and the power of the message of hope and healing and honoring your grief and your loss and Mitch's life and how it brought your family closer together were really, really powerful. So I think
thank you, Prentice. I think that if people are interested, they can learn more about the books on our webpage, which is boltonpress.org. And they can order it there. It's not ordered. Amazon, I don't think, can order my voices. It's just brand new. And we did the self-publishing, and so I don't think they even have it yet. But you can order it online, and we're about to do an e-book, so that'll be coming down the road for at least for Voices of Healing and Hope. And that's the one that has a DVD in the back. But those last questions are those issues that we deal with are pain, the emotional and physical, and that is really real. The physical pain that you experience, I vomited two nights later after Mitch died, which I couldn't believe I did. But that pain needs to be honored. And the other one was fear. Fear that it could happen to someone else. Fear that you'll never survive it. That you want to join them. There are all those issues that you have to deal with. And then depression yourself, because it's very easy to get depressed about what's just happened and isolated, as one of our callers said. And the last issue I really go in depth in is faith issues, because it challenges your faith. you know, sometimes people feel God is punishing me by having this happen in my life, and that's, I don't believe that at all. I believe people make, God gives us free will, and we use that free will either to live or not to live. And so when somebody dies, I have to make my choice about whether I survive or whether I don't. And there were four quick things that somebody said I think our listeners would love to hear about really quickly. If you tell, after you've had a death by suicide, here are some things to do. Tell the story about what happened. Tell it and tell it and tell it until you begin to believe the truth of it and absorb it into your body and mind and spirit. Express the emotions, whatever they are, anger, guilt, any that we've talked about. Write about them. Scream about them. Talk to somebody about them. The third is make meaning from the loss. Something positive has to come from this. Like our talking right now, like the books I've written, like the books other people have written. And the fourth is transition from the physical presence of the person to a new relationship, like dreaming. Or there might be a psychic phenomenon that you experience and have that person come to you in a dream or something like that. But you do have a relationship to that person. I used to talk to Mitch in the car all the time after he died. I had a different relationship. So those are the four things. Tell the story, express the emotions, make meaning from the loss, and transition from the physical presence to a different kind of connection to them, a new relationship.
Yeah, that's good information. I think fear, somebody was talking about fear in the DVD, and they mentioned just the anxiety of it happening again, of how, if they missed it that time, how are they, why wouldn't they miss it again? Another child, another, a spouse, a loved one, a client, one of the therapists mentioned, like, how do I know that it's not going to happen again if I missed it before? So
exactly.
All of those things are very, very powerful. Quick email in response to the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church no longer prohibits the burial of a person who has taken their own lives. They may be buried at any cemetery. Please make arrangements with any parish priest.
Oh, isn't that good news?
Yes, there you go. The power of radio getting the answer.
I love it.
Well, we are we're running out of time here. So, Iris, anything you'd like to leave with folks today? Something for them to take home?
Well, I think those four aspects of grief and what to do about it are really helpful. And if they do get either one of my books or get some resources and read, the poem that I wrote that is I Don't Know Why, I think just to know that you don't know why, you'll never know why, you don't really have to know why, but what you do have to do is make a choice about your life.
Yes.
And what you do want to do is make meaning out of the horror that's happened and help other people, because that's what it's all about, living in service to others. And so that's what I hope my books do, and that's my legacy to anyone who chooses to read it or not.
Well, the way to find those books is online. Go to alaskapublic.org, click on the link to Line 1 and through on the radio tab, and you can find those resources from Iris and along with some other resources. So thank you so much for sharing your story today, Iris. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. Love talking to you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right. When a person is considered a danger to themselves or others, under what circumstances can a person be committed for mental health treatment against their will? On next week's program, Dr. Dinah Miller, co-author of the new book, Committed, joins me to discuss the battle over involuntary psychiatric care. So why not tune in and learn more Monday, August 7th at 2 p.m., repeating at 8 p.m. on FM 91.1 Alaska Public Media. Eric Bork was our web editor and audio engineer for today's program. For all of us at Line One, thanks for taking the time to listen. Till next time, I'm Prentice Pemberton. Have a great day.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.